From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a one-time refugee from war-torn Bosnia remembers how she escaped from that country.
Later, an 86-year-old Grafton man shares the chilling story of the day the Germans marched into town before World War II.
Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history, so.
And a local researcher thinks an app might be the way to help OCD patients take the stress out of seeking help.
Clearly, for some anxious people, this is going to be less anxiety-producing, which hopefully would increase their compliance. But also, of course, with the app that we're talking about, people could do it at the convenience of their schedule. I mean, this could be something they could do at 10 o'clock at night.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
I'm Bonnie North. The world is facing its worst refugee crisis in recorded history. Millions of people have been displaced by conflicts in Syria, South Sudan, and other countries.
While European nations have been grappling with the influx of people, the U.S. has attempted to ban immigration from many of the countries affected by these conflicts. But the situation that many Syrians face today is not so dissimilar from another crisis we dealt with just two decades ago.
The Bosnian War started in 1992. By the end of it, just 3 years later, more than 100,000 people were dead. Most of them were Bosniaks, victims of a genocide targeting the Muslim ethnic group.
Ziada Beganovic was a young child living near Sarajevo at the beginning of the war. She later came to live in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, as a refugee, where she and I went to school together. Ziada starts by explaining what she remembers from her early childhood in Bosnia.
As a little kid, I didn't know why we were leaving. I just remember something was wrong. And we left. We moved to Germany. My mom, my sister, and I actually left alone without my dad. And I remember coming to this small town. What I know is that what happened in Bosnia is not even just Bosnia, but Serbia and Croatia. Mainly in Bosnia, struggled the most is that I think the religious differences was what brought this to be a very dirty war and a very sad war. I mean, majority of Bosnians had to leave because of the danger of the war, right? So if you were Muslim, I have friends and actually even neighbors. My mom used to say her neighbor was Serbian, and every day they would see each other. They would perhaps even have coffee in the morning because that's a cultural thing. Hanging out with friends, having coffee, morning, night, it's just part of culture, being social and seeing people. And she said, things got really strange when the war was just about to begin. People who were friends, Serbians, for example, and Bosnians, would stop talking to each other. So a lot of the religious stuff interfered, and people stopped being friends. And everyone started turning towards one path. So if you were Serbian, they turned to Serbia because that was probably their safe zone too, right? I mean, if you try to help a Bosnian Muslim, you might not make it through the war.
So when the war started, about how old would you have been?
So the war, I remember, actually as a little girl, we were outside. My mom was hanging out the clothes on those, what do you call them, where you...
Oh, a clothesline?
Yes. She was hanging clothes up, and I remember those fast military planes. I remember one flying over us, and I was just thinking, that was really loud. I know things got kind of scary, early 92, and we left in August of 92. So I was 4 and a half, my sister Jenny was 2. And we got very lucky because we were able to get out. If anyone waited, later on during that time, it was very hard to leave. Many people were stuck. If not, they wanted to stay because that's their country, that's their home, they wanted to fight. But my mom and my dad chose to leave for the safety of us, the girls.
You said that you and your mom fled. You, your mom, and your sister all fled first. Why did your dad stay longer?
I think a lot of the men had to stay to support, the Bosnian military. I don't know 100% to why. I know he had to for some reason. never really asked. It just, people don't really like to talk about the past, especially the ones that are older and know exactly what happened. It's something that's not very talked about, unfortunately.
Now, do you remember fleeing to Germany? Do you remember that trip at all?
I do. It's really weird because thinking about it, even now, I can just close my eyes and like remember parts of it. But being so young, sometimes I wonder, how am I remembering this kind of stuff? Is it because of how dramatic it might have been, or is it just my brain wanting me to remember? But I know there's few memories that I have. For example, my parents actually built a house. We finished it. We were just about to move in. Beautiful home. It's still there now. It took some time to fix it. But right before we were moving in, my parents were deciding to leave, and things were getting really bad. So where our house was, it was in a smaller village outside of the town, more secluded. My dad's parents grew up there. And I remember being at our cousin's weekend house, she used to call it, and just watching out the window, just seeing black smoke. And where our house is, there's a giant field of grass. I mean, it's so beautiful. And then you have the mountains that you can see from the balcony, for example. And I remember our mom having to figure out how to get to the road, which was past the field and some trees. And she said that we ran through those fields not knowing if you're going to get shot from the soldiers that are behind you up in the mountains. So that was a challenge because you didn't know where the soldiers were. You couldn't see them. You know, they took advantage of the trees and the forest, and you just run and you hope that you don't get hit by a freaking bullet. And I do remember we were in this car that picked us up. This guy, the driver, thought that my mom was a friend of his. Apparently she looked like someone he knew who was Serbian. And he kept talking to her, just having this conversation. I remember my sister and I, we were in the back seat on the bottom, underneath, like under the seats, just trying to be protected, just in case someone started shooting at the car. And I remember them talking, but she told me fully the story that he was assuming he knew her. And she never said she wasn't that person. He got us back into town where we were living in an apartment. So that was weird. That was probably scary for her, not knowing, like, what if he finds out? What's he gonna do? You know, you just don't know. But I remember the bus ride out of Bosnia to Germany. So we ended up getting on a bus to leave. And I remember one part of this drive, I was looking out the window, and while I looked out the window, there's half a person in a ditch and half a person on the side of the road. Same person, just two pieces. I'll never forget that. And I asked my mom about it, and she just didn't know what to say. Like, how am I supposed to know that? How is she supposed to explain that? And then everything after that was kind of blurry. I remember we finally got to some European town. I don't remember where. It might have been Austria. And we were just sitting outside. And then finally we got to Germany.
How long were you in Germany?
Let's see. From 92 until 99. What is that, 7 years?
So you were in Germany a while.
Technically, my childhood, I grew up in Germany. And then my teenage years, I grew up here in the U.S. So Germany was very open to bringing in refugees, especially Bosnian refugees, and they opened their doors, which was amazing because there were so many of us who were trying to leave and protect ourselves and survive. But around, I think, like 98 is when Germany was ready to send the refugees back home because things got better and they took us in to help us out. But then, like, now you're okay, right? Now your countries are back to somewhat stable and please go home. So we had the choice to either go home or come to the U.S. And my mom couldn't resist coming here. She's like, it's America, right? It's the land of the dreams. And how can you not take that opportunity? Because why would you go back home when your home's destroyed? There's nothing there. People are poor. Like, it's still sad over there. Like, it's getting better, but there's so much poverty there still.
When you look back at your time in Germany, as someone who was a refugee, how do you process that time?
Honestly, I think about this all the time, and my sister and I talk about it too, and even my friend Isla. It's just like something that comes up in a conversation all of the time, and to me, it feels like it's a different world. When I look back, I'm like, is that my childhood? I think about it like, am I dreaming? Was that just a dream? It doesn't feel like it's my life, because I've had my 4 years in Bosnia and then my few years in Germany, and then here, I feel like my life was just like taken apart in different pieces. And the past is just someone's story, someone's movie, and I'm just looking back at it and thinking, oh yeah, it doesn't feel real. I don't know if that answers your question. It's a really weird thing to think about, and like I have to say that being young in Germany too, you had kids who didn't really accept you for being a refugee. They used to tease you, and there's, in German, it's called Ausländer, which it's not the nice, it wasn't a nice word for anyone to call you. And some kids weren't accepting of you being different and coming to their country. So you had those challenges as a young kid, right? Like trying to fit in. And you find other kids who you fit in because they're a different culture.
Now, what was it like when you came to the U.S.?
Scary, only because I watch so many American movies and saw tornadoes all the time. I always say this, man, I remember the sky was pink the first like few days when we got here. And I was like, you guys, there's going to be a tornado. And my cousins, Lana and Dado, like, no, this is Lake Geneva. It's going to be fine. But I remember the drive home from the airport, just like the highway was so big. There's so much space. And because even in Germany, you had a lot of forest around you, a lot of mountains, right? Valleys. And one thing that I always found weird to me was that the blocks, the resident blocks, were squared, right? I never saw that before. So like riding my bike one day, I fell because I didn't know how to turn a corner from one side to the other. And I don't know, it was a different feeling coming here. It didn't feel real. And I imagine America to be so different from what it actually is.
You already had family in Lake Geneva, but did you feel like people treated you differently because you're nodding your head yes?
Most definitely. I mean, Lake Geneva, as some of you might know, is a very small, I would say conservative town. And I don't think kids knew when I came to school, right, sixth grade, I don't think kids knew what a refugee was, what war meant, what anything like that really meant. All they knew was clothes and hanging out with friends, and I did not feel like I was accepted. I found that to be very challenging all throughout middle school and high school too. It was just, you're different, right? One of my history classes, I think it was in high school, there's like 2 pages, maybe 3, about the Bosnian War. That's all, right? And kids still don't understand who you are and why you're different. I tried to avoid telling people what my religion was, only because I didn't feel comfortable. How they would react, or there's so many perceptions about religions, and especially Muslim, right? If someone being Muslim, they might be a terrorist. Like, no, that's not necessarily true. You're just not educated about what these religions are. There's this one example in high school. I don't know if this is... So remember Sparky, our art teacher?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I remember Sparky.
I loved him. He called me his angel. He was my favorite teacher on earth. And there's this project that we had for a photography class. He wanted to have us take pictures of like something pure, right? So I remember asking my mom, I'm like, do you think it would be too much or just taking it too far by taking pictures of myself or someone taking a picture of me with the hijab on, right? And she's like, no, that's who you are. You should be okay with that. And whatever kids say, that's on them, right? Like, this is who you are. So I did that. And the pictures turned out to be very beautiful, right? It showed who I am. I'm not just Ziada with the brown hair and this teenage girl. I'm actually in also another, that was like another part of me. And there are some kids that end up taking some of those photos that were hanging up in class and writing bad things on them. They wrote terrorist and some other things like that. And to kind of just be like, whatever, I laughed with them, not thinking like, no, what the hell, man? Like, I didn't stand up for myself. I laughed about it, and then I took it home, and I was like, what the hell? Then, a few years later, I'm like, why did I do that? Was I not confident enough, like, to stand up for who I am? Or did I just want to fit in with the others? I didn't realize, like, how bad that was for someone to do. And I hope that person and those people one day understand that that's not okay. You can't judge people based on what they look like. You need to know them as a person and then judge them if you want to. But know the facts. Don't just judge people.
With all the recent restrictions on, well, visas largely and immigration from a number of different Muslim majority countries, how do you feel about traveling right now? Does that freak you out a little?
Well, when I first found out that he was our president, Trump, I just freaked out because I'm thinking, well, I still have my green card. And many were like, why don't you have a U.S. passport yet? Why aren't you a citizen? I'm like, I still am. I'm still a permanent resident. I still have all the rights except of voting. And it doesn't mean that I'm not trying to be an American citizen. I'm still a proud American citizen. That's who I am. I live here. This is my new country, right? My home. And I freaked out because I'm thinking, well, hell, I'm Muslim. I'm from Bosnia. I'm sure at some point this country will come up in the conversations. And even now, before Trump, when I did travel, every time I came back home here, I was questioned. It always blew my mind. I'm like, why? You're like, they're asking you all these questions. Where did you go? Why did you go? Why did you stay so long? Where do you work? What do you do? Like, where do you live? Like, all these details. And then I see other people just walking through. The other time I traveled, actually last year, coming back, I was so-called detained. They took me to the other office, and I had to sit there, and they had to verify my documents even further. And I just sat there. I'm thinking, what the hell? I didn't do anything. I have no criminal record. I work. I have a degree, right? I went and got an education. I pay my taxes. And here I am, still being questioned for why I left this country. Is it because my passport says Bosnia? I don't know. But trying to leave now to go on a trip, I don't know. Like, it's nervous. It's nerve-wracking thinking about it, because what if they say, no, you can't come in, and I have to go back? It could happen. I hope it doesn't, but I don't know. That's the thing.
Is there anything else that you would want people to know about your experience as a refugee and your continuing experience as an immigrant here?
I mean, like, we didn't choose to leave, right? We didn't choose to be kicked out of our home because of political reasons. We're, again, just like American kids and people live here, we also want just to live our life. We want to have a family. We want to be happy. We want to be healthy. And we don't want to be causing harm to anyone. So we're not here to take resources away, right? Not just me. We got resources in the beginning. We got support. But then we got on our feet and created this life that we can now give back to others. So don't judge people, right, based on who they are and where they come from. Get to know them, and if anything, get to know the facts of who they are and such, because every person has their own story, and what the media might say about one country or one religion doesn't mean it's true with the people around you.
Well, Ziada, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. This was great.
Ziada Boganovic is a Bosnian refugee who emigrated to Wisconsin nearly 20 years ago. For more on her story, head to WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll speak with a witness to a little-known chapter of history in southeastern Wisconsin, the presence of a German nationalist camp in 1941 Grafton. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. It was the late 1930s when the rise of nationalism in Germany gave rise to Adolf Hitler, the Nazi Party, and the so-called Third Reich.
That nationalist movement was not limited to Europe, however. It was supported by German immigrants and others of German descent around the world, including here in the United States. In fact, southeastern Wisconsin was home to two camps run by a group of Nazi sympathizers called the German-American Bund.
Grafton was a town of little more than 1,000 residents and was where the Bund's Camp Hindenburg was located. There are few people alive today who were there the day the Bund came to town, and it's a history few in the community still talk about. But it's a day Skip Earnessy has not forgotten. He was 11 years old in 1941 at the time the Bund came to town. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke met him and the Grafton Historical Society's Nick Shannon in the Grafton Public Library, and Earnessy described what he saw.
Well, the thing I remember is that these Germans came marching up the street, and they had the German flags flying, and they were singing Deutschland, liebe alles, I think. And they were heading for the Grafton Hotel, where they usually held their meetings on Sundays. And because they had the German flags flying and their uniforms on us, it just so happened I was downtown at the time. A couple of us kids were down there, and we saw this. And we only had one police officer in Grafton at that time in 1941. And somehow the word got out that they were down there, the Germans, and quite a few people from the village were down there, too. And I don't know where they came from. I would almost assume they came out of Milwaukee, because there must have been at least 10 policemen all of a sudden there, and I don't know where they came from. But they made them take those German flags down, and they gave them an American flag, and they told them to get back to their camp, which was on the east side of the river at that time. And so they turned around, and they started walking up 12th Avenue here, right? Yeah, well, anyways, they came marching up this street right here past the where the library is now. Right there is where they threw the American flags down, and they put up their German flags again, and then they were singing their song and the rest of the way down to their camp, down to the river. And it was quite an exciting time for Grafton, you know, because we were a big village of about 1,100 people, which there's that many living on my block now, I think, the way the village is growing.
Well, and you were 11 years old. I imagine you kind of understood what's going on, but at the same time, this kind of thing doesn't happen in Grafton every day, even today.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It was really something, you know, something to see, and that's why I probably remember it, too, because it certainly was, I didn't realize it at the time, of course, that it was quite a historical situation there.
Do you remember what, I don't know, your parents or the adults that you knew at that time thought of what was going on?
Well, I remember we were eating, I think we were eating dinner on December 7th when all of a sudden on the radio they announced that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor and we were now at war. I really understood it after it got going because, you know, being the size village we were, when the draft came on, well, they pretty much cleaned the town out of young guys. And my dad was a superintendent at Younger Stove and Range Company, which is an old company. And they had a government contract shortly after that for making parts for something. I don't know what it was, but in the foundry, because they had a gray iron foundry. And my dad had me working there in the summertime. And what always got me was I never could tell anybody how much I earned, because that was against the child labor laws or something, and my dad got paid in cash for me, and I got $5 a week, so I was the richest kid in Grafton.
You know, you talk about the Germans marching into town, but they had an ongoing summer camp here. What was the atmosphere like between, you know, the kids like you who lived here and the people who came up, some of the kids who were up in town for that?
Well, that camp did split up. The camp on the east side of the river was on Jim Wigner's farm, and it was called the Carl Schurz German-American Camp, if I remember correctly. In fact, I think that camp or that organization is still someplace west of here. They told me on some lake or someplace. But the Bund, the Germans, the radicals, they moved out and they moved to the west side of the river on the Grafton side. And that's what's River Park now. I do remember that because on the Carl Schurz side, every summer, they were German kids, but I mean, they were all out of Milwaukee. Those were all German families, and that was their place that for summer camp. And they built a long barracks there, and the kids would be there, and because they put a fence up in the middle of the dam, and that was our swimming hole when we were kids down here at Limekiln Park. And they put a fence up in the middle of the dam and said that this was our side, that was their side, we should stay on our side, which didn't work. You know, you can't tell kids like us that. That's why I said I was the first German prisoner of war.
Well, tell us that story. How did that happen?
Well, like I said, they told us to stay on our side of the fence. Well, one Sunday morning, Joe, my buddy and I were down there swimming, and we didn't give a dang about that. So we were on the wrong side of the fence, and a couple of Germans came and grabbed us because we were on the wrong side of the fence. And we found out that Saturday, this was on Sunday morning, Saturday they had a big picnic there. And they gave us a stick with a nail in it and two Germans, one behind each of us. And they marched us through the park, and we had to pick up all the papers and put it in bags. And we finally got out of there. And when I got home, like I said, it was Sunday. And I got home about 1:30, 1:45 in the afternoon. That's when we finally got out of there. And my dad, he laid into me. He says, you know, on Sundays, we eat dinner here at noon. I said, hey, Dad, the Germans wouldn't let us out of the camp. I said, we had to clean it up. You what? You know, he's hollering at me. He said, he was going to take care of that. Well, I don't know whatever happened about it, but I know he didn't. But that's why we said we were the first German prisoners of war. So, but they did split. And like I said, the Bund came on the east side of the river, and the German Americans stayed with it with their picnic grounds over the other side. And I gave them all that information as to who owned the land and who sold it and all that. Well, that's all in there. You know, all the paperwork. Well, Nick knows that too, yeah. So they got a pretty good history that I had obtained there from, Paul Knauer, his name was. And he lived down in the park down there. And he gave me all that information, and he died shortly after that too. So I was kind of glad he gave it to me.
Let me ask you this, Nick. How much do you think the people of Grafton today recognize about this period in the town's history?
Well, I don't think that the older people know all about the history of the Bund Camp in Grafton and what took place, especially shop owners. A very good local historian would have been Leroy Paulin, who owned Paulin's Market. So now there hasn't been so much talk about it. It's just been one of those things that it still is an active organization with private membership, but they don't talk about the past at all.
This does not hold the same place in Grafton history that the music industry did, for example.
Not one bit. We're very proud of the record factory here, made records, and you know, Grafton back then, we had all of the blues singers near Black come up from Milwaukee, down south, and everything was fine with that. But they were treated pretty good from what I understand, but not so much with the Bund Camp, especially as time kept progressing and things kept getting a little worse.
See, the problem with that question that you just asked is right now I can probably count on one hand the people that were born and raised in Grafton, old people. There's a lot of old people here, but they all moved in here because of the nice community and the facilities for them, and so they know nothing about this, you know. Anything that they probably read, they would know, but if you ask them a question about it, they say, Bund, what is that, you know.
Nick, your mom, if I remember correctly, you said your mother was born and raised here as well?
Yes, she was. And she grew up on 9th Avenue in Grafton,
Did she ever talk about this period?
She talked about knowing of it, but her parents were very protective of the kids. They would not, and being that they had five girls and only one boy, you know, they had to keep them at home. They would not let them run the town like Skip probably had free run of the town. Boys were different back then.
Let me ask you this, Nick. As someone who, you know, works to preserve history, do you think it's important to tell this particular story of Grafton's history? Do you think it fits some purpose for maybe kids today growing up knowing about this kind of darker period?
Well, being a local historian here, I believe it is good to record all history, whether, you know, because Grafton went from the lake all the way over to Cedarburg, from Port down to Mequon, and our history was Yulyul Station, Port Yulyul. You need to preserve that, and as long as you're telling the truth about the history, it should be kept and made of record. And if some people don't like that, well, this is the way it was. This is what honestly did take place. And that's why we are always trying to interview older people and get their thoughts as what it was like growing up in Grafton.
You know, even considering that period, was Grafton a good place to grow up? I mean, obviously you stayed.
Oh, I think so, yes. In fact, I miss the small community. We're a pretty good-sized community now, as you know. I mean, it's growing by leaps and bounds, and I think it's growing way too fast. But after the war was over, and all the guys were back from the service and everything, Seth Liebenstein lived next door to me, and he was in the Marines during the war, and he was over in the Philippines. And they were being bombed one day, and he said he dove into a foxhole. And I forget where he said the guy that was the other Marine that was in there, but they got talking to each other, trying to calm themselves down, he said. And this Marine asked Seth, you know, where are you from? And he said, I live in Grafton, Wisconsin. He says, hey, that's where the Bund is, isn't it? So apparently Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history. So that shows you how far the word was around even during the war.
Yes, and during the wartime, there was a lot of support by all of the manufacturing in Grafton here. I know on both sides of my family, everybody was in the service. My ma did not go, and neither did one of her sisters, but they worked at a place on the east side of the river north of the Highway 60 bridge. It was called Zones, and they made submachine gun parts during the war, and so that was their effort. And then she did have another sister, two sisters, one was a Wave and one was a Whack, and then my dad and three of his brothers were all in the Army. But everybody was making something for the war effort.
It sounds like even you.
Yeah, they were making parts for the what the parts were for. I don't know, but I did learn something there though. I knew that I was never ever going to work in a foundry again, because that time I was shifting weights and that core gas was enough. I said I'd rob banks or do anything, but I'm not going back in a foundry.
And my dad, who worked at Grobe Incorporated down here, at that time it was Grobe Brothers when they started off right by the railroad tracks here in town. He worked there 44 years, and he remembered, and he told me this, that there was one German man from the Bund camp that would walk up, and because it wasn't that far of a walk, maybe a mile, and work at Grobe, and he was kind of kept to himself, eating lunch and that, and then he'd go back. And so that was one guy that was there and was employed, did good work at Grobe, but just didn't associate with too many other people. And like with my ma, being a girl in the family, all the girls, their mother and father were very protective. As soon as they got wind that the people from the Bund were up in town. Everybody kind of gathered their kids in a little bit because you did not know what's going to happen next.
It sounds like in the end it was still peaceful, but
yes.
That wasn't a given.
Yeah, it was peaceful, but you did not know. So to be on the safe side, they were very protective.
As someone who works to preserve history, it has to be important that there are still guys like Skip out there who remember this time.
Oh, I am so glad that I was able to hook up with Skip, because when John from the library here called me and said BBC would like to do something on Bund camps in America, well, you know, nobody wants to cause anybody trouble. We just want to preserve history. And John checked with me, and I thought, oh, Skip is the first one that comes to my mind. I mean, there are many, but they're all passed already. But Skip, and he has a very good mind. He's very sharp, and he lived that time period at a good age when things were memorable. So I'm grateful for Skip, and I wish that there could be a few more. I do have one other name that I'm trying to get who actually owned the cottage down there afterwards, but she's not doing well right now.
Well, Skip, we're grateful you're here too, and that you're able to share these stories with us.
Well, I'm kind of happy about it myself, really. I never really gave that a thought as far as the history of Grafton, and being a part of it was, I guess, a privilege for me to be able to still be here on this earth, you know. And thank God that the adage of only the good die young, otherwise I'd be a long time gone already.
Well, Skip, Nick, thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
86-year-old Skip Earnessy is a lifelong resident of Grafton. He was 11 years old on the day that the German-American Bund marched into the center of town. Nick Shannon is with the Grafton Historical Society.
They spoke with Mitch Teich at the USS Liberty Memorial Public Library in Grafton. Our interview first aired in March, and you can find a link to more about the phenomenon of German Bund camps at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break now, and then how a smartphone app could be the answer for some patients who deal with obsessive compulsive disorder. That story comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are many interesting biographies you can find in the neighborhood library or bookstore. They often share a side of famous people we didn't know or even appreciate. Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist says there are two that should be on your radar screen.
I love reading biographies. Sometimes they can be dry, but often they contain golden nuggets about favorite personalities that make you stop and think, really? It happened to me recently while paging through separate stories about a couple of big names, Dwight and Francis, a president and a pope, each possessing a quirky side just like the rest of us. Fox News anchor Brett Baer has written an intriguing book, 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. It's a wonderful read with a particular focus on Eisenhower's graceful handoff to JFK's presidency. As a military general and commander-in-chief, Ike had plenty of help making calls, getting around, and running his errands. So after leaving the White House, just using the telephone by himself could be challenging. Brett Baer recounts how Secret Service agent Dick Floor had to teach the former leader of the free world how to do it, how a rotary dial actually worked. Eisenhower, the story goes, came out of his home office complaining about reaching several wrong numbers. That's when Agent Floor learned that his boss had been turning the dial as if it were a safe combination. Remarkable. Baer also writes about how Eisenhower was a bit rusty behind the wheel, so much so that whenever he made a reservation at his favorite hotel restaurant, the owner would leave plenty of room in the parking lot for Ike to maneuver. That brings us to Pope Francis, who throughout most of his priestly ministry has had little to do with cars, especially chauffeured ones, preferring public transit to be closer to his flock, and on many occasions foregoing a bus or subway in favor of the sidewalk. Author Mark Shriver recalls the day Francis, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, was officially made a cardinal, an account humorously revealed in his book, Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real Pope Francis. While other churchmen proudly rode through the streets of Rome for their appointment with Pope John Paul II, Bergoglio chose to walk, all vested in red. The story gets better. Author Shriver says Bergoglio's longtime assistant, Father Guillermo Marco, was really embarrassed. So Bergoglio offered to buy him a cup of coffee along the way, in a bar, that is, all suited up at the counter for high church service. The owner was so honored, he told the two clerics their hot brew was on the house, and off they went to St. Peter's Square. My admiration for a certain president and pope hasn't changed that much. It's still high. Perhaps in being reminded that accomplished lives aren't perfect, that common behavior, even quirks, help make us more human.
Lake Effect contributor Mark Segrist is a television producer in Milwaukee.
There are a variety of treatments for people who suffer from the brain disorder known as OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. Treatments such as cognitive behavior therapy have been effective in helping many patients who deal with the disorder, which can cause severe and often crippling anxiety.
But one of the shortcomings to the treatments that exist is they rely on a patient's ability to have access to a mental health provider, which isn't always easy. Now, local researchers are looking for ways to reduce or eliminate those barriers.
Dr. Brad Riemann is the clinical director of the OCD Center and of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Services at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He leads the efforts to test an app designed to help patients treat their OCD. He joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio last year and explained.
Thankfully, there are some very effective treatments for OCD. Unfortunately, however, many people suffering from OCD don't have access to this treatment, in part because there are very few centers of excellence. So geographically, many times people don't have access to these treatment centers. And then secondly, just from a cost standpoint, even if geographically available, it may not be financially available.
So the app is the new part of this, right? I mean, you have used computer technology to work on treating OCD in the past already.
Yeah, this work is actually something that's been we've been working with for probably over two decades. And the bottom line is really that previous research has shown us that people with OCD and anxiety disorders kind of have this radar out, and they're constantly kind of scanning their environment for things that we would technically call threat cues. But basically, they're scanning their environment for things that that cause them anxiety, that scare them. So, for example, a very common type of OCD is the fear of germs or contamination. So someone with this kind of concern would be constantly scanning their environment for signs that maybe someone might be ill. So they might pick up the fact that somebody has maybe wiped their nose a couple of times sitting around a meeting table or something, whereas people without OCD would never even pay attention to that. So this radar we call is kind of this attention bias or this bias in their attention, and that seems to be at this point, a fueling source for this concern. And we've done research and developed a computer program that really targets this attention bias and has been found to kind of shut this radar down.
Well, and so this is the kind of behavior that I think historically you might go after with, what, cognitive behavior therapy?
Correct. Yep, that's absolutely right. The treatment of choice is actually a specific technique out of cognitive behavioral therapy known as exposure and response prevention. Very, very effective. But again, unfortunately, few people have access to this kind of treatment. And ERP has actually also been found to shut this radar down. But this computer program really targets it. And our hope is to really make it much more accessible to people so that they can reduce their symptoms.
Well, right. So heretofore, the technology has been available, but in a desktop kind of format, which I imagine is not quite as convenient.
Yeah, and the word available is also a part of the problem. In other words, we have published multiple studies that have found the desktop-sized version to be effective, but it's never gone from the lab to the sufferer. So part of this is also not only trying to shrink it and put it on an app to make it more accessible, but then also trying to do something about getting it into the public's hands.
So realizing that there will be things that you can't tell us, what can you tell us about how this app works?
Yeah, the good news is this program, again, that we've studied before, has been found to be very effective as a standalone treatment. So it shuts down this radar, as I'm calling it, and reduces obsessive compulsive disorder symptoms significantly. But it's also been found to be a good treatment enhancer. In other words, for those that do have cognitive behavioral therapy access, if you combine that effective treatment with this computer program, you actually enhance your effect or get even better still. This particular program really is very individualized. So we're looking at words that are associated with these things that people with OCD found to be scary or anxiety producing. So, for example, if you would have multiple people with this condition, every word list would look different. It's very individualized. So, again, getting back to my contamination concern, this person's word list might be things about germs or HIV or whatever it might specifically be. And someone else with OCD might have a very different presentation and have a very different word list. And we basically have created a program that presents these words also with neutral words, words that they don't find scary. Then basically through a system or of this program, we're redirecting this person's attention away from those scary words onto the neutral words. And believe it or not, in about 15 published studies, we have found this to be very effective in reducing the symptoms of OCD and anxiety.
So again, returning to the germ example, if you will, and of course, as we're sitting in the studio, I'm pointing at the hand sanitizer.
I saw that.
That's someone who is dealing with OCD as it pertains to fear of germs, they hear a word and they turn to their app.
Well, this would be something that would be done much more proactively. So, for example, in the studies, it would be done multiple times a week. It takes about 12 to 15 minutes to do. We would encourage them to do it at least twice a week, even more often than that if they can, daily, for example. And over the course of about a month, patients will tell us that they are no longer paying as much attention to these kinds of cues that they find spontaneously occurring throughout their day, and they will report to us on very kind of valid and reliable measures of OCD severity, less symptoms.
So you're essentially desensitizing them.
Well, it's possible that's part of it, kind of based through the old exposure, right? So we were just talking about the treatment of exposure. So there is probably an exposure element to looking at these words that they find frightening or associated with concepts that they find frightening. But I think more specifically than that, we are redirecting their attention. So it's not just kind of getting used to the words, and it is absolutely kind of shutting that radar down.
Can you give us an example of like a fear-triggering word and what the neutral word that you would connect it to might be?
Sure. You know, in the classic studies, we were trying to get as sophisticated as we could and tried to rule out any other kind of explanation. So, for example, in an OCD contamination study, the word germs, five-letter word, and we would match it, say, for example, with table, which is also a five-letter word. So we tried to match these words for word length. Believe it or not, there's actually a book that tells us how often words are used in the English language, and we would even match them for usage in the English language, basically trying to rule out that a shorter word or a longer word might draw someone's attention more than something else, or that words that we're more familiar with might draw your attention. So we really tried to rule out any other explanation. You know, so that would be an example of a word that we might match it with. And the idea is we present these words on the screen for a half a second. This is not subliminal. Everybody can read them. And then they disappear. And then there's a task that we ask people to do. There's a probe, if you will, that's embedded in the next screen that we ask somebody to identify as quickly and as accurately as they can. And the positioning of this probe is kind of the key thing to basically retraining their attention. And essentially what we do is teach them to kind of retrain them to draw their attention away from those threat words onto those neutral words. And unfortunately, I can't get into too many more specifics because I'd be giving some of the secret sauce away. And any of your listeners who might be interested in participating, unfortunately, we would probably cancel their participation out.
Do you think, I mean, is there a certain subset of patients out there for whom doing this via app might seem less threatening to them than seeking out a face-to-face treatment?
No question. You know, technology is going to be part of the future of psychiatry and psychology no matter what. whether it's in this kind of a version or even using, say, for example, telehealth. Many, many patients report feeling less anxious about visiting with their psychologist or psychiatrist over a television screen than actually face-to-face in the office. They find it less threatening. Clearly, for some anxious people, this is going to be less anxiety-producing, which hopefully would increase their compliance. But also, of course, with the app that we're talking about, people could do it at the convenience of their schedule. I mean, this could be something they could do at 10 o'clock at night or at Saturday mornings at 7:30 in the morning, you know, whenever they can find time. And so that convenience piece, because clearly what you're always trying to do is, no matter how effective a treatment is, compliance with that treatment is going to be, of course, the key. And so making it more user-friendly is just going to increase compliance.
Can you walk us through how you were trying to recruit people for this research?
You know, we're looking for adults ages 18 to 65, men and women, people who have a primary diagnosis of OCD. People can be receiving medications, but we're looking for stability in that medication type and dosage. So we would be asking them how, you know, when was the last time that medication might have been altered or changed. And we are running the study in both our Brown Deer location and our Oconomowoc location. And we are compensating people for their participation. They will come in for one kind of initial screening session that will take maybe perhaps a couple of hours. And then twice a week, really, for the next 4 weeks. So 8-hour-long sessions to basically go through the app and answer some simple questions for us. And that's kind of it. And at that point, we would be kind of also cracking the code, as they say, and because half of the individuals will be put in our placebo condition, half will be put in the active condition, and those that got placebo presumably will not have really benefited, and then we'll also offer them the active so that they could perhaps get whatever benefit that program can produce.
There is a placebo app.
Correct. Yep. Yeah, and again, I can't give away
right.
too many details.
I'm just fascinated by this idea.
Yeah, but the app, and to the untrained eye, the it's a perfect sugar pill. In other words, the placebo app looks identical except for one important but minor variation, and that's, again, kind of the piece that is going to help us retrain people's attention away from what they find threatening and thus reduce their symptoms.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much. Best of luck with your work.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Brad Riemann is the clinical director of the OCD Center and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Services at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He spoke with Mitch Teich late last year, but they are still recruiting participants for the research study, and you can find links to more information at WUWM.com. And that's Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for being along with us today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening. Fresh Air is next, followed by Here and Now at noon.